appreciate everyone's patience, because for most of us this is not an easy process. I used to be in a monastery, and 15 years of my life was in a monastery. We would get invited from time to time to talk to schools and different people. And once I was invited to speak at a place where people were, had all, were sick and couldn't walk and were in wheelchairs and had different problems with their bodies and minds. And I spoke to the young children that were in wheelchairs, saying that we all have a disability. We all have things that sometimes it's obvious that it's our body, but sometimes we all have different areas where we suffer, where we struggle. One of the nurses was very upset with me. And she was, I remember her saying with this really tight, in the question time, tight face, saying, "It's all right for you, just up in your monastery, sitting around, being happy all the time. Basically, why can't you just come out and help somebody?" And, you know, people think it's so easy to sit around all the time. It's so easy just to be happy. And, you know, she had this anguished face. I mean, if I was lying in a bed and was suffering, I think I would rather have someone that was peaceful helping me. Or at least trying to. But I don't think she understood what it is that we're doing. I mean, it looks like we're just sitting around, being lazy. Once the Pope's chief cardinal in charge of, this is a few years ago, in charge of the doctrine of the church, Cardinal Ratzinger, wrote a report on Buddhism, saying it's the greatest danger to Catholicism was Buddhism, but that it was only spiritual eroticism with no compassion and without any concrete something. Just thinking, people get all kinds of ideas what we're doing here. See how spiritually erotic it is to sit here. It's not easy being with ourselves. We're not taking a stance against the joy of contact. Like I say, it's hard to say everything at one time. Good friendship is so important in the Dhamma, in this path of awakening. Good conversation, good friendship, where we discuss these areas of our lives that cause us difficulty, where we discuss that which we've each found to be useful to help us move along and grow. It's only a small aspect of but on this retreat, that's the point of the, at least the small groups, to have a feeling of us beginning to bring into sound, bring into speech what our experience is. A special kind of experience, our experience of being with a body, with emotions, with moods, with not having to necessarily, though there's other places for that, necessarily have a view about who we want to be prime minister, or who should be the president of the United States, or how we should. There's room for these kind of discussions, but this is a certain kind of discussion about our being. Yes, that's important. But we're particularly on this retreat trying to give an opportunity to develop a relationship. A kind of relationship that sometimes there's not much time for in the world that we live in. A relationship of listening. We chanted tonight to the one who listens to the sounds of the world, the Bodhisattva of compassion called Guan Yin. It is said in the Buddhist teaching that it's been a central part of my practice and Tanisra's practice for many years, that calling Guan Yin's name activates the compassion. It helps bring the attention of the compassionate one to us. But it also reminds us to how to find compassion. Find compassion by listening. On this retreat, we're having a lot of time for inner listening, to listen to the body, to listen to the moods, to listen to the thoughts. Because the very act of listening is not just, it looks so passive. Why don't you do something? Looks like nothing's happening. But the activity of listening, of allowing something to be received into awareness, when that touches something, is not the same. It's being blessed by attention, blessed by awareness. The transformative principle in the spiritual path is the principle of inner listening, of allowing awareness to touch things. And what we, these first 3 days of it, usually the hardest days of the retreat. They're usually many times a day once considering how I can get out of here. I was planning it myself. How can we go? Because there's something especially in the world that we live in. I'm not sure how it is in Israel, but any other parts of the world, when things get difficult, you change the channel. Push the button. Colder, hotter. Channel 1, channel 2, channel 3. And now, for those who have cable, you can have 100 channels. Don't like that? Change the channel. Or then surf. Go surf. Go into millions of places around the globe. Or push a few numbers and have a phone call. Or take pills to go up or pills to go down. What kind of... There's so many ways, or kind of just, you know, open up a fridge, big fridge, you know, go to the freezer. No, I don't think I'll have that. Or I think I'll have Mexican food, Thai food, Chinese food, yes, stir fried Chinese, like. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. So many ways of just being drawn out here, drawn out there. Or then go to the movies. Even in Africa, they built a movie theater near us with 18 different movies. In Africa. 18. You go up there, you have a choice of 18 movies. Once Tanisra and I were so... This is a confession. Just to give you an idea. We were so... stressed out from Africa. When we first went, 18 people a day were being killed in our province. Political violence, it was, you know, the stresses in this country. Once we just, we have to drive 3 hours to get to the movies. 3 hours from the mountains to the nearest big city. We went to a movie, and then we went to a second movie. Then we went to a third movie in a row. Terrible movies. But just anything to kind of check out. But then when we came back, oh God, it was much harder, you know, trying to find the body again, because one was just so used to avoiding. In this kind of experience, the options for avoidance are quite limited. I mean, you can check out the feeling over here, or check out the feeling over here. I mean, you know, we're limited, but we're being limited by the boundary. The principle of religion, was meant to be a bound, a religio. Religio means to bind. To bind, not just for the sake of torturing yourself, but it was meant to bind. Or the word contemplate, as in it the word temple. A temple in the ancient times was a limitation, a boundary within which the seeker, the spiritual seeker, committed themselves to the boundary. So that then, by staying with the boundary, there was opportunity to then notice the moon sweepings, the dawn, the heat of the day, the coolness, staying with the boundary. By staying with the boundary, one has the opportunity, rather than moving oneself, because one would like this, one would like that, one would like this. Staying with the boundary, one has the opportunity to allow nature to reveal itself, and then see different things move. See the moods change, the light change, the perceptions change. We're working a lot with boundary, the boundary of sitting, the boundary of walking. And the schedule is a limitation. And as Tanisra said, the opening night, it's a baggy suit. It probably doesn't fit anyone in here. Everybody probably says, walking's too short. Longer walking, aching back. Shorter walking, more sitting to really. Some people want longer, some people want shorter, some people want earlier, some people want later. It's never perfect. It's a baggy suit. Doesn't fit. But the point is not trying to make the best schedule for everybody. The point is that within the schedule, and we've been trusting everyone to please find for yourself what is right. Sometimes you need to rest. Sometimes it's too long. Try to know your intention. But rather than trying to make the schedule perfect, we want to try to allow the boundary of the silence, the sitting, the walking to be a mirror, so that we then see the liking, the disliking, the views. We can have, like in today, one can have experiences. Mood like that, and then one can have another experience of just feeling touched that people are trying to find another way to work with the suffering of life, another way than just going blank, another way than just lashing out at someone else. So this is very difficult. Not many people do. To me, this is, and to the saints and sages, there is no, we might dream all we want to about peace. Peace, ease, freedom. It's fair enough. It's lovely to pray. I'd like to be at peace with all beings. It's lovely. But can we even be at peace with one? How about this one? To actually stop and actually take that lovely prayer, it's a lovely prayer, but to take that prayer and actually test it out even for one day and actually be with all the stuff that happens in a human body and mind, the hunger, the heat, the need to stretch, the restlessness, the heaviness, the impatience. So actually a lot of work's been done here in these 3 days, and it's not the kind of work that shows up on the gross national product and show up on the stock market. But I'm telling you, this if you invest in this stock, and this is a tip, a hot tip from me, if you invest in the BDS Unlimited, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, if you invest in this unlimited blue chip stock of awareness. If one is patient, long-term investment, it will offer us back, offer our family back, offer our country back, many, many, many things. Because what we're doing here is digesting. We're digesting the huge amount of stuff we just dump to the side when we keep shifting channels. So then when we stop, it all comes. That's why these first 3 days are hell. As we get a little more experience, we're more used to it, and so then it's not necessarily that different. But it's meeting a lot of undigested stuff and allowing it to be received with patience. Each of us right here is a big patience machine. And you know, there's too little patience in the world. But being with heaviness, when normally one just crashes out, but on a retreat one's takes a little longer to actually feel heaviness, to feel restlessness, and actually even notice it sometimes change. A time when we've really been restless and then had a chance, and it tells us I can't take another second. But then we're still here in 5 seconds. Can you hear me? You can't take it. But. And if we notice sometimes then it, when it dissolves. And yet that was so real. It was so much me. I can't take it. And what happened when it changed? Taking all these thoughts and views and perceptions as me and then acting on it. It leads to all kind of confusion, all kind of problems. So rather than being hijacked or moved or swept away by things in this activity, we're learning actually how to develop the capacity to be with things and see them change. And though we've been encouraging ourselves to, as well as possible, learn how to find a sense of easefulness in the simple things, not having 100. Once one gets more and more into meditation, it is better than cable. The simple things, being able to enjoy sitting, walking, breathing, standing, enjoy receiving a meal, receiving the energy from all the cooks that's come from the earth, and putting it there and having a chance to listen and appreciate what it means for the food to nourish us. Cultivate simple pleasures, but at the same time how to appreciate suffering. In the Buddhist teachings, this experience of being with that which is not easy to be with, what's called dukkha, it's called that which is not easy to be with, that's considered not something to be afraid of. The Buddha didn't ask people to torture themselves, but as people to contemplate the suffering that is a part, natural part of life. Being born is not easy. For a mother to give birth is not easy. For a child to be in the womb and then to be born is not easy. Aging is not easy. When we're used to our body being a certain way, then as it starts to get stiff, then as it starts to get not as energetic, sickness is not easy to be. We're used to health, vitality, then when we have pains, all these are kinds of sufferings. The Buddha encouraged us, rather than to blame or rather than to make a judgment about, he encouraged us to see this as a part of life that needs to be contemplated. Death is not easy. Being with something and then having it slip away, losing a loved one. What we chant in the morning, when we chant that being put with what you don't want to be with is difficult. What we chanted is being with the unloved, being with pain, being with someone you don't like, being with too much noise when you don't want to be with noise, being with too much thinking when you don't want to be with thinking, or being separated from what you do, being peaceful and then watching it slip away, that's dukkha. Being with a loved friend, being with a special moment, and having it shift and change, stressful, dukkha. Not getting what we want, wanting to understand, wanting to get peaceful, and getting a painful knee, or getting frustration instead, dukkha. Rather than judge these experiences or hate these experiences, in the Buddhist teaching, he encouraged us to actually be interested in this experience. In fact, this experience from the range of most painful things, what he called dukkha-dukkha, the dukkha of just pain. Break your arm, it's dukkha-dukkha, it's painful. It's painful to me, it's painful to a Buddha. When the Buddha's first cousin pushed a boulder down a mountain to try to kill the Buddha, and it broke the Buddha's toe, he experienced pain. Yet he had the experience. But what did he add to the pain? He didn't. He didn't add resentment to the pain. He didn't add cringing away from the pain. He knew the pain is the pain. All of us experience, just because we were born into a sensitive body that ages, subject to sickness, and dies. We, all of us, no matter if we're a prophet, a saint, a sage, a Buddha, we're going to experience pleasure and pain. That's just how it is. That kind of experience we can't do anything about. But we certainly can look at all the extra pain we add by not wanting it, by fearing it, by thinking it's a, why me, by imagining that it shouldn't happen. All this other pain that's generated in the heart through confusion, all this kind of dukkha, is we can let go of. And it's amazing how much pain is manifested through our opinions about it. When we're sitting here thinking, I can't take this, it's over, I don't know. How much that makes a difference when that's not there, when we're actually just being with the experience as it is, can be the difference between heaven and hell. The Buddha, when he was asked to reduce his teachings to something simple, he said, I teach two things. I teach suffering and the ending of suffering. Teaches us to not be afraid, but to want to understand the experience of how we generate through our greed, through our hatred, through our delusion, how we generate the nightmares in this world, a lot of which is generated by human beings. He encourages us to know these experiences, not just so we can pat ourselves for thinking we're racking up points for feeling suffering, but so we can understand what causes it, so that we can learn how to let go of it. And the Buddha taught that we can know that in the heart which does not suffer. We can know that in the heart which does not die. We can know that in the heart which is free, which is radiant. He actually taught vimutti sara sabbe dhamma. Vimutti means freedom, sara essence, sabbe means all, dhamma things. The essence of all things, all experiences. The essence of, all right, this experience. We don't mean being at the kibbutz on the third day of the retreat too, do you? Even when my knee hurts and I'm tired. And I don't really want to listen to your Dhamma talk. Yes, even the essence of that experience. Sometimes we imagine that the essence of all on the mountaintop when it's been a perfect meditation, perfect food, and I've let go of my lust problem and my anger problem and my mother-in-law problem and my father-in-law problem. Then I can. But sometimes we don't really imagine, even in the dull state, that the Buddha or the timeless freedom is also there, right there. Vimutti sarasa bedama, that actually the essence of all conditions is unobstructed, is free. Another way that he put it is, he says, our heart is radiant, that the heart is radiant. Already, it has light. But that we don't see the radiance because of the things that move through the heart. Because we're confused by what's moving through the heart. We don't recognize the timeless freedom or the timeless radiance. What's moving through the heart? Right now? Kirisaro's Dhamma talks, moving through the heart. It's visiting you. Sometimes we think we're moving through the day. Third day of the retreat. 4, 5, 6, 7. Actually, the retreat's moving through us. The morning breakfast visited us, then it dissolved. Now in this present moment, in the midday, the heat visited the heart, then it dissolved. Now, the coolness of the evening is manifesting. It's in consciousness, filling up our consciousness. Evening. It's visiting our heart, our awareness, being touched now by this experience. Because we get confused by what moves through the heart. We don't see the timeless radiance. We don't know our own timeless radiance. But that actually, when in any experience, when we contact it, receive it, are willing to penetrate, there then is the opportunity to recognize something in us which is okay, timelessly okay. We've already alluded to part of how we miss this timeless radiance. We don't trust. We don't trust that there's something special at the root, at the depth of this moment. We don't trust. What do we trust? We trust our views and opinions. Sometimes people think, oh, I don't have faith. Sorry for you, you've got faith. We've got a lot of faith. We have faith in our opinions. And so you could think, oh God, I could get to the truth if it wasn't for that dog. It's getting, and then we could go out there and kind of make a law that no dog can get near the retreat center. You know, we laugh at that, sounds silly, but we do that all the time. The mind says, oh, I can't stand that, and then we spend an hour, 2 hours, a week, a year trying to get rid of this. Trying to get rid of that. Trying to get to some higher level of samadhi. Yes, it's good to practice calm, but then sometimes we can spend years trying to get to the next, to the next, to the next. And then never, ever really, because we're so busy, this is called becoming in Buddhist teachings. Always on the treadmill, it's called samsara. The little hamster in the cage going around the wheel. We never, because we're always trying to get there through this liking and not liking. Because we believe and have faith and believe these views and opinions that come into the brain, come into the mind. So we're always busy scurrying. This opportunity, though it's difficult, we're giving ourselves more and more the opportunity to be with the moment and have more and more capacity to trust that it's okay to relax here. You don't have to follow the desire and the aversion. that we can actually learn more and more just to know those states. And then somebody thinks, oh, yeah, but the world would just stop if you never followed desire. And who said never? Never said never. But if one always gets hijacked by every impulse to get rid of and get, then we never penetrate to the depths of our heart. The more we know our heart, then we can purify desire, and then desire becomes compassion. It becomes the desire to help, the desire to serve, the desire to bring that which is needed for this being ourself and for others. But it's not so much trying to imagine that when I get over there it's going to be all right. As our desire is purified, then we're aware of what we're doing. And we're resting here. When the Buddha encouraged us to that we were fooled by what's moving through the heart, the way in which he encouraged us to begin to make contact with the true nature of what's moving through the heart, to allow us more and more to experience the peacefulness, is this first quality he encouraged us to contemplate change. It's called the characteristics of existence. These are not opinions you have to deeply believe. I'm a Buddhist, therefore I believe in change. You don't have to believe in it. It's an encouragement to look at the... Sometimes we assume things are fixed. We assume they're bad. Or we assume I'm hopeless. We assume things are unchanging. It's very powerful when one starts to, in one's meditation, to start to contemplate the true... It's called anicca, changing nature. Just like we can have an opinion about dogs. I mean, I don't know. How can we hear? What is that? Can we hear, receive what actually is sound? Each sound touches the awareness. Each bark touches the awareness and dissolves back. Can we let this sound... Let the dog's barking be a Dhamma talk. Each sound arises and then dissolves back into the silence. Can we take a bark and bring it over here? You can't keep a bark. It's there and then it's gone. It dissolves. Similar to the day. Not only sounds are like that, but look at the day, the morning, the midday, the evening, the Dhamma talk. You can have all kinds of opinions about it. I like the Dhamma talk, it's a long Dhamma talk, it's a boring Dhamma talk. But when we actually contact it as it is, it just keeps dissolving. The words keep dissolving. The opinions we might have about it are this way or that way, but when we touch the reality of it, it keeps dissolving, it keeps dissolving. Our body, we've been noticing that even the word breath sounds like a thing, but when we're actually with the breath, we realize it's vibrating, shifting every instant. And the out-breath, shifting, vibrating. Heart's beating, sensations, consciousness is moving, the actual experience of life is becoming otherwise every instant. And not even to mention our thoughts. Yet we have thoughts. We can have opinions. Oh, I'm hopeless. And believe that to be real. Or we have a good meditation. I've found it. I've found it. Or even the I. Where's this solid thing that it's pointing at? Deeply profound experience. Not just everybody knows things change. I mean, that's easy to think intellectually. But when we start to bring into our heart the experience of noticing that what we see right now, just notice the color shifting, changing, blinking of the eyes, what we hear shifting, changing, dissolving, what we feel shifting, changing, flickering, rippling, what we think. Follow a thought. These thoughts that get us so tangled up. Oh, I don't know what I should do or shouldn't do. The Buddha encouraged us to really explore what happens when we just see it as change. We just see the thoughts shifting and changing. And when we see that, how can we imagine that we can find a stable home by possessing that? How can you possess a thought? It eludes us. And yet we expect this body that's shifting and changing all the time. We expect our sensory experience of seeing and hearing or a loved one, we expect them to be something we can really lean on. And yet we're asking more than the sensory world can give us. Ajahn Chah used to say it's like going up to a chicken and saying, why aren't you a duck? What are you doing, a chicken? You should be quacking, not cockle-doo-doo-doo-dee. And yet we say that's stupid. A chicken is a chicken and a duck is a duck. You don't. And yet by wanting the world of flickering change, world of sounds and sights and feelings, which is shifting every instant, by expecting that to bring us stability, is like going up to a chicken and saying, why aren't you a duck? The conditioned world, the world of change, we're not saying it's bad, but it's, let's honor that world for what it is. That world is a fluid, shifting, changing. So when the changing world comes through the heart, but when we don't know that and we ask the body, bring me stability, we ask our moods and emotions, bring me stability, of course we get frustrated, get upset, because we take birth, we take hold of health and assume it's mine, we say it's mine, then when we get sick or then when we die or then when something changes, we feel let down. It's actually dukkha. It's not a value judgment, but the nature of the conditioned world is it's not stable. You can't. It shifts and changes. And it's not ours. This is a concept that confuses us a lot. The Buddha's not saying there's nothing here when he says no self. But the uneducated, the unreflective mind takes things to be self. It assumes that mood is me. When someone's in a rage and they think it's me, I want to kill you. And then when we're in a rage, we do it. We assume it's me. If one could pause and reflect and consider, is this really the wise course of action? That mood can shift and change. But we're all the time attaching and identifying with moods of rage, moods of desire, moods of unhappiness. That's called taking birth. We're having the opportunity on this retreat to see a lot of moods come up which are crying out, wanting us to believe, oh, I'm too hot. Oh, this is too lonely. This is boring. This is wonderful. We're having an opportunity to allow these parts of ourselves to die. Oh, to die. I knew it. I knew that at the heart of this there was something bad. Yes, it's allowing some false notions about ourselves, to return home, to return back to the silence. All kind of voices, all kind of moods, I can't take it. What happens if we really kindly, this is not a cruel dying, kindly listen to that voice well up and then dissolve back. When we believe these opinions about ourselves, we limit, actually our being is vast, we limit ourselves to a condition which ensures that we change and keep us born and die. Can we ponder, just to experiment, what is it like to give things back to nature rather than thinking this is my body? To actually ponder that this has come from the earth, from the sun, from the wind, from the rain, and when this body dies, it goes back to earth, and water, and air, and fire. Actually contemplating when moods and thoughts come, contemplating rather than me, contemplating that it is a mood. It belongs to nature, it belongs to Dhamma. Buddha's first disciple that had insight, what he was aware of was what arises ceases. That seems so simple, and yet he was the first disciple of the Buddha to taste Nibbana. He realized that whatever comes into being dissolves. He deeply saw that, and in deeply seeing that, he let go and experienced peace. Whatever arises, an in-breath arises, it ceases. A thought arises, it ceases. A body from our mother and father coming together, a body arises, it also ceases. A galaxy comes into being, it dissolves. And sometimes it's very useful, really useful, to deeply contemplate what we see. We hear, what we feel, what we think is arising and ceasing. It is all part of the conditioned world. If we let that be, give it back to nature, then what can we discover? The Buddha taught that there is that which does not die. He said if there was only that which is born and dying, if that's all there was, then there would be no freedom, no escape from birth and death. He said, because there is that which never dies, because there is that which is timeless, then we can also know freedom from birth and death. So what is it that remains? This is a deep question that is asked in the path. What is it that does not die? We don't just speculate about that. We learn about that by being willing to be with birth and death. In this process, we actually are studying birth and death. When you're with an in-breath, that's birth. When the in-breath dissolves, it's gone, it's death. With an out-breath, it's beginning, then it dies. A sound, like those dogs, our teacher told us, rather than being upset by sound, realize that each condition will take you home. Each condition will take you back to your own timeless true nature. Even the bark of a dog? Yeah. The bark, the sound of my voice, it's there, and then when it dies, where does it go? It dissolves back to the silence. The aware silence, which is with us all the time. We don't even notice it because we're so busy being fascinated by the forms, fascinated by the thoughts, fascinated by getting somewhere. We don't even notice this quality of timeless presence that each sound dissolves back into. timeless quality is just an analogy, but it's like a bed. It's like a ground that can hold us. I used to be a wrestler for many years. I had big muscles. I was a champion wrestler when I was 16, 17, 18. Then I got my shoulder ripped out and had to have 4 screws put into my shoulder. After the operation, I was in the hospital. You know, in the hospital bed, sometimes they have a little railing above the bed so you could hold the railing. And I guess this arm was operated on, so I must have been holding it like this. And then I was tired. I wanted to lie back in the bed, but this had just been operated on. And, oh, it's long down there. I don't know what's going to happen if I have to fall. But I trusted it. There's a bed down there. And I let go, and it was a little scary, but then the bed caught. I landed and could relax. We don't trust that there is a bed, a ground, something real, timelessly real in the heart. We don't trust, and so we're always grasping at that which moves through the heart, grasping at a sight, grasping at a sound, grasping at a thought of getting somewhere, grasping at the opinion that it'll be all right if I just get rid of that. Can we, little by little, trust in that? Not to hate conditions, to honor conditions, but to realize that they're changing, realize we can't grasp anything. We can just appreciate it. We can be with it. We can be gentle. We can respond to conditions, but we can't keep them. So can we practice letting be, letting go of thoughts, letting go of an outbreak, letting each sound take us back to a place of rest, a place where we're being held by the ground of our being, by the silence itself, by the presence itself. Even though the world might say this is just imagination, even though the world doesn't think this is real, actually what the world thinks is real is really changing. Very ephemeral. And as we explore more this depth of letting go, we can discover something which is timelessly peaceful and present. Encourages not to be afraid to let things die. Just have the courage to be with the different moods. Let them well up, not out of cruelty, but let's hear them. Hear them shift and change. Allow them also to keep melting back into the silence, so that all the orphans of our being, all the things we're scared of that we push away, can keep dissolving back into the heart. And get a feeling of resting in our own being, resting in that place where all things come together. rather than having a walking and a sitting, I'd like to leave it up to each being to sense what is needed. For some of you, you need to rest. Some of you, you're welcome to walk or sit down on your own. To get a feeling for us following our own body clock. But I'd like to finish by chanting the sharing of blessings. It's on page 6. All the really good work, difficult work that we've been doing these days here. May we allow our heart to feel the joy of sharing with our whole Dhamma body, our mother and father and all beings, because this is for the welfare of the whole. So truly may the goodness of our lives benefit all beings in all directions. That arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of Death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the death. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. The forces of delusion not take, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.